Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Today's guest just may change the way you think about war. Ed Mann was born in Redding. He grew up along the Trinity River, and he currently lives along the Sacramento River in Shasta County. He served a tour of duty in Vietnam as an infantry soldier, 1st Air Cavalry Division, from June of 1969 to June of 1970. He was awarded a Silver Star, an Army Commendation Medal, a Bronze Star, and 2 Purple Hearts. When he left the Army, he finished a 4-year degree at UC Davis, then got a law degree at Colorado University. He practiced law in Redding for 20 years and is now retired. Today I'm going to ask Ed Mann about the memoir he has written, Jungle Ghost, Walking Point in Vietnam. Ed Mann, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, you know, I didn't even open your book before I had questions. I looked at the title, Jungle Ghost, Walking Point in Vietnam. Do you think listeners know what you mean by walking point?
Well, the first person, when you're moving through the jungle, you always go through the jungle single file. I mean, it's very thick. Sometimes it's so thick you have to use a machete to cut a path. So it's single file, and the first person is the point man. That's the person that walks point.
Well, you do have a glossary in the back of your book, so thank you for that. I appreciated the glossary. In addition to the wonderful photographs you have in your book, so thank you for those photographs and in color. But those two words, jungle and walking point, were not in the glossary. I wouldn't expect it to be, actually. So you are a young man. Here's this young man on the cover also, while we're on the cover. And you write how you got to Vietnam. And would you like to read some of your introduction?
Sure.
And I'm sure you get this questioned or got it. What was it like in Vietnam?
That's how I started. I said, what was it like in Vietnam? And I wrote, Vietnam was many things to many soldiers. Most of them completed their tours performing jobs that didn't expose them to close quarters combat. But a small percentage weren't that fortunate. The majority of those were infantry soldiers, men who viewed themselves as grunts. That's what we called ourselves.
Well, and that's one of the words that's in your glossary, because grunts, us non-military would need to know some of the vocabulary in military language.
I don't know how it started, but it felt right that we were called grunts, because you just worked hard. It was hard work. Some of them fought in the rice lands of the Delta, and some fought in the dense inland jungle areas. I served in the jungle, and this is how I viewed that after a couple of months. We weren't the only company that was suffering casualties. Several men in our sister C and A companies had recently been killed, and as we prepared to leave, I was seeing an increasing number of guys with pen and paper in hand, almost surely reaching out to their loved ones for what might be their last time.
Just that sentence right there is just hard to believe that this is what you were faced with.
As you get into the book, you'll realize that all of us knew that next, at any time, anywhere.
But you say you didn't talk about that.
No, we didn't talk about it. We talked about a lot of things, but we didn't talk about that. It was just, you didn't talk about dying. We didn't talk about fear of dying. We didn't talk about leaving our loved ones. We talked about everything but that. But we all were aware of it every step we took in the jungle. And what I said was, I wasn't one of them. I wasn't going to share any of this with the people who cared about me. The thick jungle, the hiding, the whispering, every step taking me to unfamiliar vistas and potentially lethal sight lines. The bugs, the littered night perimeters permeated with the scents of feces and urine. The weight of our packs, the wet, the heat, the hunger, the weekly stomach-churning orange malaria pills, and the threat of getting wounded or killed that never, ever released its toxic grip, especially on point days when we knew that if anyone was fated to die, it would probably be one of us. We were We were bitching about the weather, the way they were using us, the food, all kinds of things, but we never talked about the scary stuff. Nothing about our fears, our thoughts of our loved ones, our thoughts of death. The terror of being hunted left us with joyless faces, sometimes etched with naked fear. All of us moving slowly, cautiously, fearfully, and forever aware that death was lurking somewhere in the shadows of the dense forest. That was the reality that had brought so many awake screaming in the night. But there was another side to that deadly peril. The jungle was the place where adrenaline pumping, heart thumping, and breathlessly vital moments awaited us. And the thrill of that was pulling at me.
This is my guest, Ed Mann, and he has written a memoir, Jungle Ghosts, Walking Point in Vietnam. And he and other young men were found themselves in these circumstances. And I've read books by Vietnam veterans, and there are not that many of them, because I can understand why they would not want to write about it. But you were willing to. So why did you write this memoir?
There are a lot of books written about Vietnam. Most of them were written by officers. Some of them were written by people that philosophize on it. But you don't really see, in fact, I don't know that I saw any, that were factual stories written about the people on the bottom, the enlisted men that do most of the killing and most of the dying. And I thought, our stories need to be told. They are told by people that did those kinds of things, but usually they're, you know, I shot a guy at 1,000 meters and, you know, I have John Wayne kind of stories. That's not real. We weren't these heroic young men that were willing to, proud to die for our country. That's not what we were. We were just everyday young men put in a situation where you had to fight to survive.
Well, one thing that amazed me was your detail. When you describe things, I can see, I can smell, I can feel what you're describing, unlike any other accounts, because I wonder, how did he remember this? I can barely remember what I did last week, but you have such detail in your descriptions. How were you able to do that, Ed?
When I was there, I realized early on that I needed to be Walking Point. Walking Point is the most dangerous job. Those guys, whenever we make contact, almost always the point man gets killed. Sometimes he just gets wounded. In order to survive that, you have to develop certain abilities. And those abilities are instinctual. They're not, you can think your way through some things, but in the jungle, everything moves. Everything changes. Scents, sounds, animals are everywhere. It's thick. You can hardly see. You have to be able to reach into the jungle. You have to be able to sense the jungle. In order to do that, adrenaline helps. You can do a lot when you pump adrenaline. Your eyesight's better. Your hearing's better. You think faster. The world slows down for you. You have to do all those kinds of things. When you're in that state, everything is very, very vivid. And you can't recreate that, I don't think, unless your life's on the line. When you're prey, that's what we were. We were prey.
P-R-E-Y.
P-R-E-Y, yes. Yeah. And when you're that, it's amazing what your brain can do, because our survival brains are not our thinking brains. They're different. And so for me, that vividness stays. I can still see those scenes.
Well, you were also saying that the point man was expected to get killed or wounded, and that brings me to mind the body count, that they just expected a certain percentage of you, I almost said kids, you young men to die. And so we just hoped that we had fewer of our young men to die than the Viet Cong had of their soldiers to die. And that just seems so heartless to me, that that's how they bragged about, oh, we have a good army because our body count's lower than their body count. Am I misrepresenting that?
No, you're not, but it doesn't even describe how stupid their tactics were. Basically, what they did is they dropped companies like mine into really thick jungle we'd never stepped foot in before. The NVA were there. They were battle.
NVA, you might explain.
North Vietnamese Army
in
soldiers.
In case people hear different initials, it's a V, NVA.
NVA.
Yeah.
They were North Vietnamese Army soldiers, hardcore, battle-hardened soldiers That was their country. That was their jungle. They dropped us into it. The idea
was— They mean the helicopters.
No, the helicopters, but the people sending us. They sent us into that. And basically, their theory was that we would kill so many NVA that they would have to stop fighting, that they would just give up. The way that they thought they could do that was to put us in that thick jungle, because they couldn't see into that thick jungle. I mean, the canopy covers it. Everything in the jungle is hidden. Everything we did was hidden. Everything they did was hidden. So they put us in that jungle, and they were going to move us through the jungle and walk us into the NVA. They knew that when that happened, the first two or three guys were either going to get killed or wounded, but they would then have identified where the NVA were. Then they would bring their air power in. Now, why they thought that the NVA would stick around after shooting the first few guys, I don't know. But it just didn't make sense. And basically what it was, you can't go through the jungle with a lot of guys, like a company of men, without the NVA knowing you're there. So basically they knew where we were. They knew where we were going. They could ambush us at any point. And the other thing about that that was so silly was their idea that they would kill so many of the NVA that they would quit fighting. Those people dug their own graves on the way to attack landing zones, fully armed LZs. They had dug their own graves.
Oh, now you just used a term, too, that's not in your glossary, LZ. The initial LZ is?
Well, there's different kinds of LZ. There's a landing zone when they bring you on a helicopter and drop you. That's a landing zone. But there are also what they call permanent LZs, and they're like a football field surrounded by bunkers and with bunkers inside. And it's fully armed with artillery and concertina wire, barbed wire outside of it. The NVA would attack those in waves, and hundreds of them would die. How do you win a war fighting against people willing to die? I used to see choppers and what we call Puff the Magic Dragon, which was a fixed-wing aircraft that could just cover a football field with bullets and nobody could survive. I used to see the NVA fire machine gun bullets up at them, and then all that hellfire would rain down on them, and a few minutes later, another crew would be firing bullets again. It's pretty hard to win a war against people that believe in whatever they're doing enough to be willing to die for it like that. Now, you can not lose it. You can keep fighting it. But how do you ever win it?
Well, the news from Vietnam was the news when a certain period of my life, during this very time you're talking about, you'll be on the news. And now I just feel lied to. I feel that they exaggerated the number that were killed, Viet Cong that were killed, and minimized the number of soldiers that we lost.
It was a real awakening for me when I was in Vietnam.
Because you grew up a trusting young person. You trust what people tell you.
It never occurred to me that they would lie about something as important as that. But what I found early on, was that let me start again. If you're an officer leading a combat unit in Vietnam, and success is measured by the number of them that you kill versus number of yours that get killed, and you start reporting bad numbers, your war record, your officer's record, looks horrible. Not only does your record look horrible,
so you have a strong motivation to lie.
Your commanding officer's record looks horrible, and your division officers, all of them look horrible. So what happens is all the pressure is on those people. It's like cheating in a class. If 90% of the class cheats and the other 10 doesn't, guess who gets the bad grades? So what they did is they lied. They lied. They just exaggerated it over and over again. I didn't realize that till I got there, and when I found out, it was just shocking to me. But it's all the way up the ladder. It's not just your platoon leader. It's not just your company commander. It's not just your battalion commander. All the way up the line, every one of them has an incentive to exaggerate it, and that's what they do. And what they did. So those kill counts, guess who is like scores on a ball game? We were always winning the ball game. I was out there. I kept thinking, what makes them think that we're in their jungle, moving through their jungle? They can choose when to fight us, where to find us. We don't have any choice in that. What makes them think that we're going to win that battle on kill counts?
My guest is Ed Mann, and his memoir is Jungle Ghosts, Walking Point in Vietnam. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Vietnam War veteran Ed Mann, whose memoir is entitled Jungle Ghosts. Well, you've mentioned the jungle and this canopy. So would you read a section in your book, the first time that you're walking under this jungle canopy?
Our foxhole was dug mid-calf deep when I was told I'd been selected to go on patrol. I emptied my pack of everything I didn't think I'd need and joined the patrol on the lower edge of the perimeter. By the way, this is my first day in the jungle.
And that pack, oh gosh, I can just imagine how heavy that, because you tell us what was in those, that was heavy, that pack was.
80 plus pounds. Rainey was there, dirt streaked and somber, along with eight other guys. Rainey was a guy that actually came to the company with me. Our patrol leader was an E6, that's a sergeant, squad leader on his second tour of Vietnam. He selected a guy to walk point, and we followed the point man to the tree line that edged a tall section of jungle. And then we pushed through the brushy tree line, and for the first time in my life, I was moving beneath a dense jungle canopy. I'd been anticipating this moment for a long time, and like a boy kissing his first girl, I experienced a rush of vivid impressions. The hanging mass of intertwined foliage anchored high in the trees formed a thriving sea of green that almost fully obscured the sky. Long and leafy vines hung from that canopy like twisted ropes, and some of them stretched all the way down to the large leafed, light-collecting shrubs that were reaching up from the jungle's shadowed floor. The lushness of the overhead canopy and the low vegetation created a confusing maze of browns and greens that limited visibility in every direction. And the sauna-heavy air it trapped was filled with the rich odors of damp earth and the exotic scents that were new to me. The teeming vegetation, the strange scents, and the overhead canopy that seemed to have added a third dimension to the earth's surface made everything seem surreal. And then the haunting cry of an unknown animal sounded in the distance, and I felt like I'd stepped onto the surface of an alien planet. Those moments forever imprinted themselves in my memory. And then, eyes wide with wonder, I followed the men ahead of me, moving deeper into that incredibly exotic world of sights, scents, and sounds and threats, just a jungle newbie, trusting my life to men who knew so much more than I did.
This is Reading native Ed Mann, and he's reading from his book, Jungle Ghosts, Walking Point in Vietnam. And you're telling us this is the first time that you are walking under this jungle canopy. And you also mentioned the likelihood of a point man getting shot, perhaps killed. And people might be wondering, well, good grief, if Ed walked point, did he get shot? Because you're sitting here now, healthy. But you do tell us that, in fact, you did get wounded. Would you read that section of your book? Ed, it's a few pages over from where you were just your first time in the jungle. It's on page 33.
Okay. But I wasn't walking point here.
No, but I
did get wounded.
You did get wounded, yes.
Okay. I'd seen what those mortars had done. And by the way, this is still my first day in the jungle. I'd seen what those mortars had done to that bomb crater, and I walked straight to the foxhole and lowered myself into it to see how deep they dug it. It was only waist deep. I told the others with the NVA who had mortared our crater had been headed our way. And without a word, one of them retrieved their trenching tool, climbed in the hole, and started digging it deeper. I was standing beside the foxhole waiting to take my turn when something enormous smashed into the left side of my body. I had a vague impression that I was flying through the air, and then I was lying flat on my back, slack-bodied and befuddled. The left side of my chest was throbbing, and I reached my right hand under my tattered shirt and touched a warm, wet opening just above the level of my heart. Without giving myself time to anticipate the pain, I inserted my index and middle fingers into the opening. My fingers penetrated midway to my second knuckles, and then the tips of my fingers encountered solid flesh. There was another opening a little lower on my chest, and when the tips of my fingers reached through to solid flesh and I knew that my chest cavity hadn't been penetrated, an immense wave of relief flooded through me.
Now, there's an example of how detailed your description is, because I think if it may have, and I got shot, or that would be about the extent of it. But you tell us what you really did and how badly you were wounded. And
I still remember how relieved I felt when I realized that it hadn't penetrated my chest cavity.
Yeah. Now, if you get wounded like this, obviously if you're bleeding, how are you going to get out of there? Where? How are you going to get help? Did you have a medic there in your... Because these point groups were small. So you didn't have a medic walking along with you, did you?
We actually had medics in the jungle, but I didn't get to a medic for probably an hour and a half because we were in a firefight. And there were a lot of guys that were a lot worse wounded than I was. And I was in a foxhole with another guy, Rainey, that came with me. We were in a foxhole, and all the other guys on our section of the perimeter were gone. They were all wounded. And so there was just Rainey and I. And we were the ones closest to the jungle, and that's where the shooting was coming from. So we stayed there and shot back as best we could for a long time.
Well, you said the foxhole smelled of gunpowder, dirt, and blood.
One that I rolled into, I crawled out of there.
Would you continue reading that?
Okay. Weapons were firing at a frantic pace, and muzzle flashes lit the flickering images of men dragging others to safety. I could hear the shooting and some yelling voices, but the sound seemed muted and distant. I realized that I was lying exposed, but I felt detached, like I was dreaming. I told myself to wake up, that this was real, and that I needed to get back to my foxhole. I was confused because I didn't know where my foxhole was. And then I realized that any foxhole would do, and I rolled to my stomach, intending to crawl toward the nearest muzzle flashes. I reached out with my left hand, and when I started to pull myself forward, a fiery stabbing pain in my chest brought me fully awake. The pain took my breath away. I rolled to my side to recover, and then I steeled myself to accept the pain and started forward, pushing with my legs and pulling with my right arm to the edge of a foxhole. I rolled into it. Someone lying on the bottom of the hole grunted loudly when I landed on him. The foxhole smelled of gunpowder, dirt, and blood, and I lay unmoving, gathering strength, waiting for my ragged breathing to steady and trying to figure out how the guy on the bottom of the hole and I were tangled. I tried to work my way off him gently, but I couldn't help kneeing, elbowing, or stepping on him. He gasped several times, but he never complained. When I finally got my feet planted on the bottom of the foxhole, I rose to a crouch beside the guy firing the M16. I didn't know who he was until I heard Rainey's voice asking if I was okay.
So Rainey is your friend that you're there with. And
yes.
So you said you had to wait, an hour and a half before you were able to get help. So, I was amused at reading how the helicopters, when they did come to get you out, how did the helicopter pilots do? I mean, it must have been scary for them.
This is one of the, acts that I witnessed in Vietnam that I'm just really kind of in awe of was that what that chopper pilot did.
And when I'm reading this, I'm practically holding my breath thinking, oh my gosh, he's still there? He's still letting soldiers get loaded onto his helicopter? How's he going to take off?
Yeah. Actually, I wrote that, if I can find it.
Well, you thought that helicopter pilot was brave. you describe him as being brave to do what he was doing.
Well, it was more than brave. Here's what happened. The screaming medevac came thundering out of the night sky. It flared to a stop almost directly above our foxhole. I'm talking about Rainey and my foxhole, hovering so close that I could feel the pressure of every wump of its thumping braids. The door gunner's machine gun was spitting bullets into the tree line, and Rainey and I ignored the pelting stings of the debris the churning blades were whipping at us and added our M16's bullets. The door gunner stopped shooting, but we kept firing as the chopper settled slowly toward the ground. Before the runners touched the earth, men rushed out of the swell bearing the first of our wounded. They kept bringing more wounded men to the chopper. And as the load grew heavier, the pilot kept upping the tempo of the chopper's blades to keep the chopper's runners resting lightly on the ground. They kept loading wounded until the chopper's blades were hammering deafeningly and the body of the chopper was shuddering under the strain. The distinct pings of bullets biting into the chopper's skin sounded, and a voice on our radio yelled frantically, "Get up, get up, you're taking fire." The pilot and his crew were sitting ducks for an RPG, that rocket-propelled grenade. But in a voice that suggested he had all the time in the world, the pilot replied very, very slowly, "Ah, thank we got a little more time. Why don't you just load a few more of those boys on here?" They loaded two more wounded men on the chopper, and when the men who'd brought them scrambled back to the depression, the medevac was isolated on the ground behind us with its 1,000-horsepower engine screaming at full power and its blades hammering so hard that the air they were deflecting off the ground was shaking the chopper like it was a rag doll. Bullets from the tree line kept pinging into the chopper. I emptied another magazine, and when I snapped in another one, the howling hurricane of noise coming from the chopper hadn't moved. I glanced back and saw the chopper's runners elevating an inch or two into the air and then collapsing back and hitting the ground hard. I turned and fired another magazine empty, and when I looked back again, the machine was shuddering so violently, that I expected it would break apart at any moment. I fired another magazine in the tree line, convinced that the medevac was too overloaded to get off the ground, and that it would either break apart or they'd have to land it and take some of the wounded off. But the chopper's engine kept screaming maniacally, and the next time I looked back, the runners were bouncing higher and touching down more gently. It took forever for that chopper to tiptoe a few feet into the air. As it rose, the tempo of the bullets biting into it increased. It was becoming an ever more exposed stationary target, and my shoulders tensed in anticipation of an RPG rocketing past us, blasting it apart, and sending broken pieces of it flying at us. Somehow the pilot coaxed the medevac a little higher, and then he tilted it nose down and skimmed it just above the meadow's grasses. It crossed beyond the northern edge of our perimeter, and then he picked up enough velocity to slingshot that weighty bird into the starlit sky. I heard the sounds of that heroically crewed medevac chopper dim in the distance, and there was just the NVA and us trying to kill each other in a deadly slice of nighttime Vietnam jungle.
The scene you just heard was read by Ed Mann from his memoir, Jungle Ghosts, Walking Point in Vietnam.
And you'll note that I never got on that chopper.
Well, I'm reading this when I was reading it, just like I was watching the movie of this.
It was an amazing sight. And what was silly was the same company commander that had put us in a position where we were in the middle of a meadow and they had the cover, and then called in flares all night, so we lit up all night. He's the same one that put the strobe light where that chopper was going to come down. He brought that chopper down right where that RPG had hit. It didn't make any sense. It was closest to the tree line, but it was away from him.
Now, you mentioned Rennie as being with you there. There was something that I found touching that you had this. There was a guy named Ron, and Rod's dad was in the State Department. He was military. Ron's dad did everything was perfect. He was so successful. And Ron one day says, "I never could do anything right." And that's just heartbreaking that a dad would tell his son something, that you never do anything right. And that just, you can imagine what that did to Ron. And he said, I could never do anything right. And but on the other hand, your dad was just the opposite. And that was so heartwarming. How was your dad not like Ron's dad?
He was just the opposite. You know, Ron was actually, I didn't understand why Ron would be there, because almost all of us weren't connected to anything. We didn't have money. We didn't have parents that had privilege. We didn't have...
His privilege should have gotten him out of that situation. He shouldn't even have to have been there in the first place.
You know, a doctor, you get an excuse. You know, somebody in the National Guard, you get in the National Guard. You don't have to go. You know, somebody on the draft board, your name doesn't get picked. You know, all of that. Ron's dad was very high up in the State Department. He absolutely could have gotten Ron out of it, or he could have gotten Ron in a position where he's a photographer or something. And
he did. Some cushy desk job.
Yes, and Ron did it because he was trying to make his dad proud of him. So he's of the, and Ron was not a guy that was adventuresome. He hated it, but that's why he did it. My dad, I don't know, he just loved me. I remember I wrote it in the book. I played a football game where I really didn't have a good game, and I was feeling miserable. My dad was a World War II combat vet. He didn't like crowds, but he would come to the games my senior year, and sat in, way back in the stands. And then he left right before the game was over. He didn't like crowds, but on that day he came down on the field. I was walking off the field. He came down on the field. I saw the shadow and his arms on my shoulder. It's my dad. My name was Bucky for him. And he said, hell, Bucky, everybody has a bad game sometimes. And he walked away. I mean, he knew how bad I was feeling, how badly I was feeling. He just came down and you know, I thought, you know, my dad doesn't care. You know, and, you know, it's just the opposite of Ron's dad. You know, he's trying to make him happy. My dad was just happy with me.
Well, you know, I don't know that Ron's dad was an exception, because I know a friend whose dad, he overheard his dad tell somebody, he'll never amount to anything. And here was a guy who had a PhD at age 24, and his dad had said, he's never going to amount to anything. So I'm hoping that maybe potential dads or dads reading your book will say, oh my goodness, I'm going to be careful what I say to my son.
My dad gave me confidence, because even as a young man, 16, 15, 16, you know, I was pretty reckless and did some crazy stuff. But if any time that I asked my dad for advice, he would look at me and he'd say, hell, Bucky, he said, I've made too many mistakes in my life to tell another man how to live his life. And he made me think for myself. And he had confidence that maybe I'd make the right choices. As it turned out, I made a lot of bad choices. but you know, that's
how you learn.
That's part of becoming who you're going to become.
After a break, Ed Mann and I will continue our conversation about his memoir, Walking Point in Vietnam. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest who has written a memoir. His name is Ed Mann, and his memoir is entitled Jungle Ghosts, Walking Point in Vietnam. You mention often letters, and sometimes you wouldn't get them, and you get a whole bunch of them. So you have a section in your book, Letters from Home, and I was hoping maybe you'd read that little section in your book. This is on page 232. Letters from Home.
Oh, yeah. I've been getting an occasional letter from my friends, Mike Iverson, Phil Lewis, and Jim Webb. More often, there'd been a letter from my sister Evelyn or my mom. My dad had written two or three very brief letters, too, but most of my letters had come from Barbara. Barbara was the girl I was kind of dating. We were going out. We weren't, like, steady, but...
Well, I know a lot of guys that went off to war and had a girlfriend at home, and she wasn't there when he got back. She didn't stay with him.
We had never made any commitments, but she was special. Anyway, most of my letters had come from Barbara. She'd written almost every day, but she mailed them in batches. And on log day's mail call, Ron Balin handed me an inch-thick packet of her letters. She sprinkled them with her perfume, and when I walked past the guys who were waiting on their mail, the scent of her perfume generated some soft, good-natured hoots. The weeks-long no-mail interval had sometimes made me question whether she'd been hesitant to write because she'd met another guy. I wouldn't have faulted her if she had. She knew I might not return, and that if I did, I might not be the right guy for her. And I'd sometimes wondered if it wouldn't be better for her if she had moved on to someone else. I didn't want to lose her, but my remorse for the suffering I thought my death would cause her made me want to have been loved by no one and free to do whatever felt right without having to worry about who had hurt or what I'd lose. That wasn't possible, but I distanced myself after suffering those dark days. The dark days I'm talking about were after I'd awoken one morning with the certainty that I wasn't going to survive. It wasn't an intellectual certainty. It was an emotional certainty. And I kind of grieved my death. And those were what I called my dark days.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't possible, but I distanced myself after suffering those dark days by accepting death. I still thought of returning home at times, but it never felt real. Or maybe I never let it feel real. What felt real was a lifelike image I had of myself slipping down a shadowy jungle trail to the specific light-dappled place where my life would end. Accepting that had cleared my mind and lessened my fears, and I wasn't going back. That's how I wanted it to be, just Vietnam with no distractions, and then Barbara's letters would pull me in like the scent of that fragrant fir bough my sister had sent at Christmas, and the world I left behind would come alive again. I didn't think it through at the time, but I think her gentle written voice was nurturing a resilient thread that stretched halfway across the sphere of the earth to the girl I'd seen standing on the other side of a dance floor 3 years earlier. And I think those letters helped that part of me that was thoughtful and humane reanimate the part of me that resonated so unreservedly with a powerful drumbeat of conflict and danger. I knew what was coming, and I waited until we'd set up our evening perimeter to read her letters. She had written of running into my friend Phil Lewis at the Chico State College campus.
By the way, your wife, I gave away the fact that you married this wonderful person.
Yes.
And she was an alum from Chico State.
Yes, she was.
And at that time, it was Chico State College.
Chico State College, yeah. And her plans to visit her mother and stepdad in Washington State during the Christmas break, and news of her roommate, Chris Berge. I envisioned my friend Phil's exuberance, Barbara's graceful presence, working as a waitress and a secretary. She did both of those, putting herself through college. And her long drive up the I-5 freeway to Washington, all everyday events in the lives of people who were living incredibly distinct lives from the ones we were living. And then I thought to myself, they'd be foreseeable one-year older versions of themselves, but who would any of us be after this year? I'd had that thought before, but I wasn't pondering that as I burned her letters one by one. I was pushing back against the pain of yearnings and hopes.
This is Reading native Ed Mann reading from his memoir, Jungle Ghosts, Walking Point in Vietnam. And you say, I burned her letters one by one. You burned her letters?
I didn't carry an extra weight. I mean, seriously, I went hungry. I went thirsty. I went wet. I got rid of my poncho. I didn't carry an extra weight. But the other thing was that if we got killed and our pack got picked up, we didn't want any letters from home in our packs because who knew what they were going to do, right? You know,
yeah.
I imagine that they did write some letters to people talking about the war, talking about how we died, you know, trying to create more sadness and anger. Whatever it was, they told us to do it, and I did it.
Well, I was thinking that if you're writing a book, that letters could be a source of helping you remember. Oh, yeah, that's the way that was.
Every letter that I wrote home sounded like it was written by a 5-year-old. Because I wasn't going to tell any of them. Yeah. And the only one, my dad knew that. He asked my sister. I wrote one letter to my sister. I said, I want you to know what it really is like here in case I don't make it back. And I wrote one letter to her, which she lost. I'd never seen it. But my dad one time went to my sister, Evelyn. He said, Evelyn, he said, I want to know what's going on over there. And she said, what do you mean? And she said, I want to know what Bucky told you. She goes, I don't know. And he said, no, Evelyn, I want you to tell me. And she said, okay. And she told him. But he knew because in World War II, he'd done the same thing. He had written, I'm sure, happy talk letters back to his family.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
So that's what I did. You know, hey, it's fine here, nothing going on.
Sheesh.
You know, when I had the job as a colonel's orderly, it lasted a very short time.
Oh, there's a funny part of your book.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. So you, the title of your book is Walking Point, but you got a rather cushy job, Ed.
I got the best job in the world to get out of the jungle. I mean,
so it takes you out of the jungle and you...
All I had to do, I was taking a shower and this captain walked by and he was kind of chubby. And I looked at this captain, this chubby captain, thought, boy, if you go to the jungle, you're not going to be chubby for long. And I kind of smiled at the thought. I don't know if he thought I was being friendly, but I was standing naked in the shower and he came up and asked who I was with. And so I said, I'm with B Company. So what do you do? I said, I'm a squad leader. He said, oh, that could be a problem. I had no idea what he was talking about. But what he said was, I want you to go interview for a job as a colonel's orderly. And so he told me he had time. And I went and told the guys in my squad, and they said, oh, you got to do it. It's the best job in the battalion.
I guess so.
All I had to do was bring him breakfast tray, a lunch tray, a dinner tray, buff his shoes, and straighten out his hooch. That would be my full-time job. And I didn't want the job. I didn't want to do it, but I knew that I was going to die if I stayed, if I didn't get out of the jungle, because I was Walking Point. And not only was I Walking Point, but they were asking me to Walk Point in really bad places. And so I thought, well, the problem was that there were two things going. I mean, I wanted to live, but nobody could Walk Point like I did. Nobody else had a chance. I had a chance. At any given moment, I had a chance if there was an ambush. I had a chance. So all these other guys, I'm leaving them. And somebody's going to be Walking Point. It's like a death sentence. And I felt
so
like...
So you left this job as an orderly for the colonel.
No. I did the interview, but I didn't try to get the job. But I got it anyway.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. And so then my guys were leaving, and I'm sitting there going, it just felt wrong. So the first thing I had to do was bring him a breakfast tray, and I did it. That's the last thing I did for him.
He thought he can get his own breakfast tray.
He can get his own tray, and he can clean up his own stuff, and I'm not going to do it. And I didn't want to ask him to send me back out, because if I did that and I got killed and one of the guys talked to my family, they would say, hey, Ed, has to come back out. And then they'd have to think, well, why'd you do that? And it's like people commit suicide. You wonder what you could have done. I don't want to do that. So I didn't. But I made sure I just didn't do anything for him. And I kept thinking they'll send me back out, but he never did. And then so like a week and a half later, we went to New LZ and they made me the colonel's driver because there was Mountain Yard Village, the only place we were ever around civilians. So I took the sergeant major to the village one time, came back, took the Jeep, and went to the Special Forces camp that was nearby. There was only three guys. Drank beer with them, stayed a couple of days, came back. Nobody said anything, so I took the Jeep and went back. Well, then pretty soon the colonel showed up in the mail Jeep, because I don't know why we had two Jeeps, but we did, and said something to me, and I gave him kind of a smart-alecky answer. And when I got back, they sent me back finally. But it just felt wrong. I felt miserable every day I was back. And when I got in that chopper to go back out, it just felt like I'd done the right thing.
Well, you mentioned he could clean up his own mess. There's a rather messy job that you had for a while. You also mentioned this guy that was chubby. And there was a guy that you picked out the name Sugar Bear
right.
for this guy. And he didn't like you. Why did he not like you, Ed?
Well, he didn't like anybody. But it was, I think, a defensive reaction on his part, because underneath it all, he did absolutely want to be accepted. But I named him Sugar Bear because for people my age and maybe your age, they used to have these Sugar Crisp cereal commercials, and they'd have this happy bear named Sugar Bear. And they would sing, "Can't get enough of that Sugar Crisp, Sugar Crisp." And it was, these little kids were little smart little kids were always stealing stuff from him, but he was always good-natured about it. And Sugar Bear looked like that. He'd kind of had curly blonde hair and looked kind of a chubby face. But he was just the exact opposite.
But people didn't like him. You give him this nice nickname, but he didn't. People didn't like him, but you kind of took up for him. So Sugar Bear just being Sugar Bear.
Well, he was not well liked. He would lash out at people. But it's just who he was.
You and Sugar Bear worked at this. I just want to hold my nose when I ask you this question.
Oh God, yes.
Because we don't usually see these in movies, because movies glorify war as wonderful. But what was that job that you did for a while?
Oh, it was burning waste, really. They'd collect the waste in a barrel underneath these seats, and then you'd have to drag it out, pour diesel fume in it, light it on fire, and let it burn. So they sent me to do that with Sugar Bear one time, and that's when I called him Sugar Bear. He was so delighted that I had to go along.
Serves you right, Ed. You're going to do this dirty, stinky job.
I know. You know, the thing that people don't realize is that when you're in a war like that, even though you're the people that are doing most of the dying, you're not treated well. You know, they eat better where you're not. They live better where you're not. The stuff they sent us, the supplies they sent us were secondhand stuff. The sodas were stuff nobody wanted to drink. And you're in the middle of this situation where you don't have choices. So you're getting orders from people who don't even know what's going on. They're telling you to do stuff. They've never been there. They don't go there because they don't want to get killed.
And yet they're the ones making the decisions.
And yet they're making decisions. So the decision makers, the army's a bureaucracy. People talk about being the best and the brightest. I guarantee you it's a bureaucracy. And if you look at any bureaucracy and ask who gets ahead in bureaucracies, it's not the people that say you're wrong. It's not the people that say, I'm going to stand on principle. The people getting ahead in bureaucracies are yes people. And the yes people aren't necessarily the brightest people in the world. And so that's what you're dealing with. And so then you get all the way down to us. And, you know, we're given tactics and strategies that just don't work from people who've never even been in the jungle, don't know what it looks like. They're looking at grid maps that make everything look so clean. It's not clean. It's three-dimensional, filled with all kinds of threats, not just NVA, but all kinds of threats. It's miserable. It's hot. You know, you pack in 3 days' supplies, sometimes you run out. I ran out all the time. You know, went a day without water in the jungle. I mean, it's miserable. And, you know, that's just the way it works. And all the way up the ladder from us, when you left us, the cost-benefit decisions change. So from us to our officers, they were papering records to get promotions because we weren't staying in the military. Most of us weren't. They were. So they're trying to clear their records. Don't get me wrong, we had some good ones. Lieutenant Coklaw, who wrote the introduction to the book, was one of the really...
He wrote the foreword.
He was one of the really good ones. We had a guy named Valtz who was a warrior, but we had miserable. My first captain was a coward. He was a coward not because he was scared. Some people get scared. That's just it. And some people sometimes can't do things because they're too scared. That's just fine. That's not cowardly. But he was a coward because he put people more at risk to bring himself less risk, and that's a coward. But anyway, all the way up the ladder, it changes. And so, and the thing is, those people making those decisions, they're not risking their lives. They're risking our lives. And their kids aren't coming home in body bags. People like my family's kids were. And those politicians, in World War II, some of the Kennedys died. Ask how many people And how many politicians' kid died in the Vietnam War? I don't know that any of them did.
And you mentioned those body bags, like you mentioned two guys that there was not really any body to put in the bag. There were just pieces, like a leg. And it's just heartbreaking what...
It's sad, and you know, it's just arbitrary. You know, like a mortar falls, you don't know where it's going to hit. Somebody shoots through a sight line, you happen to be in it, you know. After a while, you know, you get so that you don't get in those sight lines, or you find cover when that mortar's landing, you know, you get a little better at it. But, you know, for me, I think I was probably as adept at staying alive as anybody there. But there's no guarantees.
My guest is Ed Mann. He was born in Reading, and he is lived in the North State. But he served a couple of years in Vietnam. Jungle Ghost, Walking Point in Vietnam is the name of his memoir.
I want to say one more thing, too.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know how close we're getting to the end of this, but everybody that was in the jungle that took one step in that jungle was courageous because it was frightening. I mean, it was like being in a horror movie, you know, where horror movie where there's some monster outside the house and they're rattling the window, they're rattling the door, then it gets really quiet and you don't know where they are. It was like that. Everybody that took one step, and I've had guys that exaggerate what they did there. They don't need to exaggerate. Just taking one step after another in that jungle took an amazing amount of courage. And none of us really had to do it. You know, you could find a way out. But I think we all did it. And even when we were going in places that were really, really scary, because they put us in some places that they couldn't even fly choppers over, we all went. We all went for each other.
I just am so glad you wrote this book, Ed. I want to remind readers one more time. The title of the memoir is Jungle Ghosts, Walking Point in Vietnam. And the author is Ed Mann. Thank you, Ed.
And by the way, I never agreed with that war, even when I was there. Thank you, Nancy.
Listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.